Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. Josh Proven's back with us today from Historyland. Hey, Josh.
Hi, Alex.
We're going to go basically on a mission to butcher the Polynesian language, aren't we?
That is what we are doing.
Pretty much.
Yes, like the dirty colonialists we are.
Yes.
We're just going to go out there and we're going to make a mess.
Yeah, and then everyone can obviously storm in and call us every name under the sun. Because Absolutely. We are here with good intentions, aren't we? Because we're going to talk about the kings and queens of Hawaii.
Yes, we are. Excited about it.
It's brilliant. So, obviously, Hawaii doesn't become a state till, what, the 40s, 50s? 50s,
I think. It goes territory and then really late on becomes a state.
So, we're talking about between sort of 1780 and about 1890, aren't we, roughly?
Yeah, that's the spear.
Okay, so start with your first king.
Well, the first king is also one of the most important kings, if not the most important king, and that's Kamehameha the Great, or Kamehameha the First.
What does that name mean?
It means, as far as I've been able to figure out, it means the Lonely One. He may have had different names before that, but the name that he came to power with, Kamehameha, is the Lonely One. Yeah, it sets him apart, and he was a guy who was set apart from other people. He was a very larger-than-life figure. The scale of his achievements and himself personally, it's actually quite fitting, even though at first glance, like you say, it's an odd name to maybe for a king.
Yeah. I mean, he is quite epic, isn't he?
He's
an all-rounder. He achieves great things. So give everyone a rundown. Why is he so great? What did he do for Hawaii?
Well, in a great part, I think it's probably fair to say that Hawaii, well, it certainly wouldn't have had the same history that it has had without him. It may not have existed as the entity of Hawaii without him. And we probably wouldn't be talking about the kings and queens of a place called Hawaii without him. He unified all of the, I believe there are 8 islands in the Hawaiian chain. He founded the Hawaiian monarchy. He was just so many things. He was a great general. He was a great leader. He was a politician of great. I'm using the word great a lot, and maybe that explains why he got called the Great. But he was I don't know what the right word is. People, because he was a conqueror as well. He was also a conqueror. He fought. He had to unify the islands by fighting to conquer them, pretty much. And he did this from 1781 to right down to 1810. So, you know, contemporary to the Napoleonic Wars and the end of the American Revolution, this guy, you know, he was a successful conqueror. I'm not sure if he was the great to the people he conquered on the other islands, but because he won, he became not only a conqueror, but a peacemaker. And wars became almost immediately less frequent and then just died out altogether between peoples of Hawaii. He instituted new laws. He laid the groundwork for Hawaiian sovereignty, basically. I mean, you could do an entire episode on Kamehameha.
Yeah, because he's not just the arts as well, isn't there?
One of the most interesting things about him was his understand, because he did it all as well with almost pure isolation. You know, a lot of other places in the world. You know, got interfered with, like we're joking about at the beginning. But this was pretty much his show. You know, the amount of Europeans in the Pacific, you could kind of count on both hands. And he had to, and so this happened in a Pacific bubble. What he was very good at was utilizing foreign technology. But instead of actually going out and saying to different nations who just weren't close enough for him to approach, because you know the USA wasn't really around yet, and Britain didn't have a great presence in the Pacific, and the Russians were just about there, but there was no one around except Polynesians. He kind of made shipwrecked people and captured sailors, his advisors, and things like that. And they helped to train his army and things like that, and helped to run guns to help him defeat the kings of Maui, Kauai, and Molokai. By 1810, he was the undisputed king of the Hawaiian chain. And the Hawaiian flag, I believe, is his doing. He went out of his way to then try and make sure that Hawaiian sovereignty remained sovereign.
And when we talk about him commanding an army as well, I mean, it's an army of 25,000, isn't it? And they are armed with cannons and muskets. It's a modern army.
It is. I don't know how this man does not have a movie or some sort of HBO series. I am absolutely astounded. I mean, how can... It happens in Hawaii, for starters. There's a blinking war with hundreds of thousands of people in Hawaii.
And that in the middle of the Pacific.
Exactly. But yeah, he has an army that rivals like the size of the army of the United States in the American Revolution, which of course was almost immediately disbanded and down to like 3,000 men or something like that. So he actually controlled the largest body of fighting troops between, you know, Philadelphia and Tokyo, basically, at one point. And yeah, this was a by the time he actually conquered the islands, this was a streamlined killing machine. This thing, he had special divisions and brigades in it. I'm using that term kind of just loosely there, but he had special attack squads to go in and mess up the enemy lines, and I've seen stuff that suggests that he based a body of his troops on like a Macedonian phalanx, and so they were like pikemen and also musketeers, and he had artillery, which he got from some of his shady European friends, who he made chiefs for getting him the guns. And he was building like European style ships at one point, and mounting cannons on his war canoes. So he had a fleet as well. So yeah, this was an incredibly powerful army, and with him at the head and his generals, it had some hard fighting to do, epic fighting you might call it. Again, I don't know how this guy is not in popular media more. But it conquered all before it. He did what Napoleon could not do.
I mean, did he meet Captain Cook, or was he in the room? He was in the same room at least as Captain Cook at one point, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was in the room where it happened.
Yeah. Because there's like a discrepancy, isn't it? Was it him that met him, or was he present when somebody else met him?
Yeah, I think that is a discrepancy that crops up here and there. He was in the room. He was one of the... This is where he gets the right to rule from, if this little bit, is because he's the nephew of a high chief of Hawaii, which in Hawaiian, I believe, is the Ali'i Nui, called Kalaniopuu. And Kalaniopuu is the guy that Captain Cook meets in 1779. Mm-hmm. But one of the officers says that he met a guy, massive guy, because Kamehameha was 7 feet tall, and personally very strong, very quiet, very capable warrior, just personally.
I think you don't have to say a lot if you're 7 foot tall and armed with cannons and muskets.
You don't really need to. Yeah, you let the other things do the speaking for you. But yeah, he seems to have met Captain Cook, and he certainly met some of his officers, and he was on the ship. I think it's been implied that he might have been in at the killing of Captain Cook, but I'm not sure if that's confirmed or not, or whether it was just like he was a famous guy. They know he met Captain Cook once. Maybe he killed him. I don't know. That's probably legend.
So what is Mana?
Okay, well, that's, yeah, Mana is a concept that's very difficult, I think, for people who... it's a very deep concept.
A spiritual thing, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So in talking about it, it's highly possible that we're going to butcher the meaning of it. But in simple terms, it's an aura of power. It is when the All Blacks do the haka.
Yes.
Right? That creates mana. That feeling you get that is projected out from them, sort of thing. It's the chills down your spine. That's them creating a mana, a sense of power, of inner strength, right? And the Ali'i, who are the nobles of Hawaii, believed in this sort of creation and collection of mana. So by the way you lived your life, not just by, you know, doing a dance, a war dance, and making people scared, by living your life, by doing noble things, by ruling well, and creating prestige, you were creating this aura of mana, which was a very spiritual thing, and it was taken ridiculously seriously. It was a matter of life or death. If you somehow impugned someone, then you were hurting not just them, you were hurting their mana.
If you cast a shadow on them?
Well, yes, that's another thing as well. There are a great amount of laws in ancient Hawaii handed down to the time of Kamehameha, which meant things like you weren't, for the Ali'i, who had to be set apart because they were very special people, you know, the nobles in Hawaii, it was considered a terrible thing to look one in the eye if you were not yourself of a similar rank. And if you even cast your shadow on them, it was a very, very dangerous thing to happen.
Kamehameha is basically, it's said, even in his lifetime, isn't it, that he holds extraordinary mana.
Yes, yes.
That absolutely. This inner strength and power just radiates from him. But he's not an asshole about it, is he? Because does he not institute something called the Law of the Splintered Paddle?
Yes, he does. Yes, he does.
What is that?
The Law of the Splintered Paddle goes back to a rather embarrassing incident for Kamehameha, where he's in one of those times during the Wars of Unification, as they're called, where he's not doing too well and he has to retreat into a remote part of the island. And he's out one day chasing some raiders, I think, and they set up on a beach and he chases them out and he gets his foot stuck in a strata of rock. And one of the guys who was running away from him turns around, he's holding this paddle, and he whacks him over the head with it and then runs away. Kamehameha never forgot this feeling of helplessness when he couldn't defend himself. And so he instituted the Law of the Splintered Paddle, which is something that in a very broad sense, because it's actually kind of, as with all laws, there's quite a lot of levels to it and things like that, but is designed to protect people who cannot defend themselves and cannot take care of themselves from people who would be able to do them harm.
I think he sounds exceptional, but he does die. And when he does die, as with this is quite common throughout history, isn't it? When someone of this magnitude dies, there's a huge vacuum of power where he was, and that creates problems for Hawaii, doesn't it?
It does. It does. Very interesting problems as well. Because, I mean, like you say, it's just so true throughout history. When you get a guy like Kamehameha, it's in Hawaiian circles, and I think even in world circles, to be honest, this guy, he's like up there with the other greats, rulers. And and that vacuum is a very dangerous thing for any new monarchy, any new state. So what you get is his son, Kamehameha II, is technically the guy who's going to take over. Kamehameha has several wives. He actually has quite a lot of wives, actually. But his favorite wife, who we have been talking about how to pronounce her name, and I believe it's pronounced Kamanamu or something like that.
I think we were going to go with Kamanu, weren't we?
Kamanu. Kalamanu or something.
It's our best effort.
Yes, we're very sorry. We're very
are, but we love Hawaiian history, and that's why we're going to persevere with this.
Yes, so we are. And yeah, so this, and she, how she is Kamehameha's favorite wife. And she feels that Kamehameha II is not her son, it's someone else's son. Mm-hmm. She feels that she would like to stay in power. She feels, I mean, probably wisely, that Kamehameha II is kind of an untested guy.
Yeah.
And at least she knows what's going on. And she also is a woman who wants to see some changes in Hawaii, in society.
Let's do a tangent because this will help make more sense of it. Religion in Hawaii and what kapu is. Because she has a serious problem with this, doesn't she? And I quite understand her point.
Yes. In a nutshell, and podcasts are nutshell things, the Hawaiian religion, where it has many admirable, the ancient Hawaiian religion, where it has has a lot of admirable qualities, where respecting of the land and things like that, and spiritual elements that a lot of people might find very attractive. There's no doubt about it that it was somewhat discriminatory, to say the least, especially towards women. And the most dramatic instances of it are contained in these things called kapu, which are, again, simplistically speaking, a kapu is like a taboo. It's a place you cannot go. And a thing you cannot touch, and a place that is sacred. And these kapu laws were very restrictive towards women, even noble women, despite the fact that women almost certainly fought in Kamehameha's army. They would not be allowed to eat with the men. They wouldn't be able to eat bananas and certain foods. Those are just two of the most dramatic examples of the laws that people had to put up with.
As someone who hates bananas, I'm not going to comment. They make me gag. This thing is particularly not nice to women, is it, Kapu?
Yes, it absolutely was something that made women's lives unnecessarily difficult, or just. If you're a noble, of course, you had certain advantages that might offset it, but it was irksome. It was to a degree, and by this time, it's obvious that even people in Hawaii were finding it, the nobles, I should say, because the ordinary people of Hawaii wouldn't have been able to effect any change on this system. So it had to be a noble, like Kamehameha's wife, to change, to even try and think of changing it. And she did, because she felt that I want to be in on running the country. And if I'm going to be in on running the country, I need to break kapu. Mm-hmm. And so she got together with some other ladies of royal birth, such as Kamehameha II's mother, who I believe is called Keopuolani. And a couple of other people, like a high chiefess, as she's often called, Kapiolani, and quite a few other royal women. And they pretty much, if I remember the story correctly, it is that Kamehameha II comes back to Hawaii from another island, and he's going to take the throne, and they basically all ambush him. With a luau, and they take him back to where they're going to eat, and basically come and eat with us. And he does eat with them, and that essentially breaks the traditional kapu that women cannot eat with men. So that's the first strike against the old religion. And the leading lady, Kahumanu, becomes a sort of regent called the Kohina Nui, as she wanted. and she kind of rules Hawaii alongside Kamehameha II as a result.
Yeah, so unsurprisingly, then, Kamehameha, one of the mm-hmm. features of his reign is to bring in Christianity in Hawaii, isn't it?
It does happen parallel to his life. I don't think he had very much to do with it, because he mm-hmm. actually traveled to Britain and sadly died there with the measles with his wife. Yeah. But yes, the 1820s is when Christianity comes into Hawaii, and that brings up a lady we just mentioned, mm-hmm. a woman called Kapi'olani.
I think that you've used the phrase fighting for the soul of Hawaii for this period. The Hawaiian people don't necessarily, of course, react well, do they, to this concept of Christianity?
They don't particularly know. No, not at first. But on the other hand, what's interesting about this sort of fight for the soul of Hawaii is that Christianity is actually a little late to the ball game, to use an American phrase. Because this happens in 1819, immediately after Kamehameha I dies, almost. And that vacuum of power creates all this mess and power plays between the members of his household. The first missionaries are a year away still. Christianity, though would be known as a concept due to his mercenaries and things like that, isn't something that they're particularly worried about. And it's not being pushed. What happens here is very much a case of the royal women saying, we really don't like these kapu laws that are being so unfair to us, and we won't get rid of them. However, traditionalists said, this is heresy, and we're going to overthrow you. And there's a short war in 1819 where a bunch of traditionalists go against the royalist faction and they get defeated, which again is another blow against the old religion. Christianity then once it's pretty much suppressed, once the traditionalists suppressed, and Hawaii has no, is a kind of reeling, and is a state of, we don't actually have a formed kind of state religion anymore, in a way. Then the missionaries arrive, and of course the door's open to new ideas. Now, I mentioned this woman called Kapi'olani, and she is a distant, she's a removed relation to Kamehameha through a different chief. And she studies at a missionary school in about 1821 or something like that, because she's interested in what they have to say. And she decides that compared to the Kapu system, Christianity offers a certain liberation almost in terms of religion, and that she can get on board with it. And she becomes a very, very vocal proponent of it in the islands.
Let's talk a little bit about the character of monarchy in the middle of the 19th century. What was it like? It's a constitutional monarchy, isn't it? Is what it becomes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very modern monarchy.
Yes. One of the interesting things about the Hawaiian monarchy is it's very adaptable, and it adapts itself as much as possible to try and fit in with the royalist club around the world. And in 1840, during the reign of Kamehameha III, it becomes a constitutional monarchy, which institutionalizes certainly Christian values within the nation. This is the start of it building a reputation of trying to show the rest of the monarchs of the world that this monarchy is one that you can recognize as a monarchy.
It's like that brotherhood of monarchies, isn't it? It's like, yes. Hey, look, we are modern, we are forward-thinking, we are not some backwater in the middle of the Pacific that doesn't know how to behave. We're one of you.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the reason that we mentioned before, Kamehameha II went out to Britain and caused quite a splash, was to try and meet King George IV. And for the rest of the existence of the Hawaiian monarchy, they very much play to the tune of what they believe to be the what's the word, the tenements, is it, of what a monarchy should be. So they be that, and they actually then they succeed very well, especially in the middle of the 19th century. Like you say, its character is a constitutional monarchy. There is a clause written into the constitution that if the main branch dies out, the newly embodied legislature, built up, made of two houses of nobles and representatives, will elect the next king from the available bloodlines. And while at the same time it would have required a very strong royalist faction to have maintained the monarchy all the way through to the present day, which unfortunately didn't happen, mm-hmm. It was a good model. And to be honest with you, I think the Hawaiian monarchy was, for its when it was good, when things were going well, was a very successful one.
So tell us about Kamehameha IV.
Right, he's an interesting guy. Kamehameha IV was considered by a lot of his people to be sort of kind of the last of the great Hawaiian, truly Hawaiian monarchs. He is very famous, popularly speaking, for doing his best to encourage healthcare in Hawaii. We can't, that means that one has to bring up the fact that one of the big important factors of this period of time is the dramatic depopulation of the native Hawaiian people, mm-hmm. Who from hundreds of thousands in Kamehameha the first time, by this time had dropped to around 60,000 due to diseases brought in by the wealth of traders and foreigners who had come into the country. And so he thought he wanted to do something about this, and he wanted to create a healthcare system. And for some reason, the legislature wasn't too keen on the idea of spending money in that sector. And so he and his wife Emma created what is now known as Queen's Hospital in Honolulu. Which is now a state of the art hospital. And they're quite famous for trying to do good works. But there's another side to Kamehameha IV, and that is a jealous side. He had a very beautiful wife, Queen Emma. He himself was a very handsome man, but he was very jealous of them. And this didn't lead down a particularly healthy road, because he was so jealous of her. He decided that this courtier was having an affair with his wife, right? So. Yeah.
Paranoia is always an attractive trait in a husband.
Isn't it? Isn't it just? But, and then it's probably even worse if your husband is the king.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, but if I was the king and I thought my wife was having an affair with somebody, I would probably find some subtle way of getting rid of them to, like, some other place, you know. Send them
somewhere cold and horrible.
Yeah, send them around the world. I need you to go and see the Russians in Siberia for me or something like that.
But I want a map of Siberia, incredibly detailed.
Go and map Siberia, would you? Kamehameha IV drank too much one night, got into a boat, because he was on a yacht when this happened, went back onto the mainland with a servant, packed a gun, and shot him.
Oh, classy.
Yeah, and the poor guy died. He lingered on enough for the king to realize that he had been wrong, that there was no affair, and apologized profusely for it, and then the guy died.
Now, so originally when he wanted the gun, apparently, he said to a servant, go get me a gun, and the servant went, no, you're drunk. So he beat him up and had him sent to prison?
Yeah, he did. I mean, this is a great character stain on this man. There is no doubt about it. I've even read recently stuff about him possibly beating his wife over this. So not the best sort of recommendation of the king in this.
Yes. By the time we get to Kamehameha V, the sovereignty of Hawaii is in decline, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And this is to do with trade, basically. The trade of the Hawaiian Islands had originally been built on sandalwood, which was a very lucrative good sort of thing to trade. And but by the middle of the 19th century, the sandalwood crop was pretty much so depleted that you couldn't make money off it anymore. And so they needed sugar, because sugar grows well in Hawaii, but they needed to import sugar to grow it. And this created a spiraling tornado or whirlpool of deals with the United States.
Who, of course, in the whole of the period we've been discussing, has been getting bigger and more powerful.
Oh, yes. They're at San Francisco now. Big port in San Francisco. And like we were saying at the beginning, one of the reasons Hawaii was able to establish itself so strongly was because there was just no one around to mess with them.
Yeah.
And now we have the Americans at the doorstep, and even the Russians are pretty close by as well. There was a period as well that where people were building forts in Hawaii, like the Russians had a fort and the Americans had a fort. But now they're in San Francisco, and because of the fact that so much American interest is being piled into Hawaii due to the introduction of the sugar crops, you get the sugar barons with them, American sugar barons coming over. And a lot of them get into government positions as well, and it's just not very healthy for the country. Kamehameha V, I believe he institutes another constitution, an updated constitution, to try and kind of make things a bit more flexible for him to control, and his government to control the new direction the country is going in. But the inescapable fact, which if you read the letters of Mark Twain, which date from 1866 when he went out as a reporter, you'll find pretty quickly that there is so much money and so much potential in the Hawaiian trade. America of the time, which was a pretty greedy so-and-so, was almost certainly going to try and extend its influence there, because the Pacific is opening up. They have and they need places in the Pacific to enhance that trade.
We come to the end of the line of Hawaiian mm-hmm. monarchs with King Kalakaua. I'm mm-hmm. going to go with that.
Yep, I think that's good. King Kalakaua is an interesting guy as well. He's a much nicer guy than Kamehameha IV. And
frankly, I'm just glad we've changed names, because now I'm not so confused. Yeah.
I know. Well, I mean, if we were to be really specific, each of the Kamehamehas has a first name, which sometimes yeah. they're referred to, but that could be just equally as confusing. But yeah, well, we've got to King Kalakaua, and he is one of the elected kings that I talked about a little while ago, because the line of Kamehameha dies out with Kamehameha V, I believe. They have to elect from a different branch, who are related to the guy, to a relative of the first Kamehameha. And originally they chose a guy called Lunaliho, and he died after a year, and then this guy got it. This guy is called David Kalakaua. He was a very interesting guy. He's known in some circles. I've heard it said that it was nicknamed the Merry Monarch of Hawaii. If you see photographs of him, he's a very regal gentleman. He's kind of a pleasant looking guy, fun loving guy. In many ways, he was well suited to being a king. He had quite a good deal of experience working in the Hawaiian legislature. I believe even Mark Twain said that he, you know, if he became king, it wouldn't be too bad a thing, because he kind of fits the bill. But he was extravagant, as the title Merry Monarch would suggest. And he had a bit of a weakness for gambling and for partying. Of course, he was also...
Weakness?
Yeah. he liked to have a good time.
Yeah.
And he also, unfortunately... happened to inherit the throne at a time where now American businessmen were pretty much in a great deal of governmental power. And they were able pretty much make him a kind of a figurehead due to what they call the Bayonet Constitution of 1888, where a mad bunch of, right, so Hawaii does not really have a standing army anymore. It has a bunch of militia units, and one of them is pretty much all white unit in Honolulu called the Honolulu Rifles. And this unit is used by a bunch of businessmen to kind of muscle Kalakaua into signing this treaty, this new constitution, which pretty much allows them to gain a great amount of influence in Hawaii, political influence in Hawaii, and kind of reduces him to a figurehead. They tried to actually oust him and give it to his sister, Liliuokalani, but she said no because she didn't want to be a figurehead. And so poor old David Kalakaua is pretty much left to travel the world because he travels to Britain and to many of the courts of Europe. And what he does do is he's the last great sort of guy who's trying to raise the Hawaiian monarchy into a recognizable international monarchy that other monarchs would like to be allies with or defend. He builds the Iolani Palace in, I believe, 1883. And he has a lot of parties there, very long parties. Some of them can last up to 2 weeks.
Awesome. And,
yeah, if you got to be his friend, despite what Robert Louis Stevenson said, because Robert Louis Stevenson, like Mark Twain, had a bit of a sarcastic tone on him. You know, he just liked to drink too much. If you got to be his friend, I think you were in for a pretty good time, really.
Yeah.
I mean, Robert Louis Stevenson said that he was kind of dreading going to a party once because he wouldn't be able to take all the drinking and was obviously going to die. But he did his best, but the political situation in Hawaii was pretty much only going to be retrieved by a guy of the stamp of Kamehameha I.
Yeah.
And David Kalakaua was a good time monarch. He was a very... One of the things that is interesting about him is he would have probably made a very good British monarch. He was very much like Queen Victoria's son, Edward, in a way, because he just didn't have a good enough constitutional support system that would defend the Hawaiian monarchy as an institution. And so he died, and he also died childless, which was another problem that. They'd had very bad luck with heirs towards the end as well. But most definitely an interesting character, very colourful character. And if you go to Hawaii now, a lot of the stuff you'll see the Hawaiian monarchy is because of him.
Oh, well, so why there is no Hawaiian monarchy now, their estate. How does the monarchy topple? What brings monarchy about the end of it?
The monarchy topples because of that militia unit again, and the set much of the same suspects of the Bayonet Constitution colliding with the remarkable figure of the last monarch of Hawaii and Hawaii's only reigning queen, Liliuokalani, who is David Kalakaua's sister. Just to be clear, although there's only one reigning queen of Hawaii, there were many queens who are obviously consorts. But that, you know, right at the beginning when we were talking about the regent position, that's called the Kuhina Nui. And that there were six of them, actually. That became an institution in 1840. And there were six of them, and four of them were women, mostly related in some way to the king. So that was just an interesting factoid I'd throw out there, to say that there is a kind of woman, a female ruler in Hawaii throughout this time. It's just that position got abolished later on.
Yeah.
So we have this collision between Liliuokalani and these businessmen and these militia folks, this bunch of rebels. They're pretty much just wanting to take over Hawaii. They're actively now wanting to take Hawaii from the monarchy. and pretty much sit and then just shout over to the United States of America, please annex us. Because we're really, really... pretty much that is the plan. And they are given this opportunity on a silver platter, because with the best of intentions for the survival of the monarchy and the sovereignty of Hawaii, Liliuokalani decides she's going to proclaim a new constitution in 1893, I think, which would give a lot of power back to the monarchy. In a way, it would have reversed the idea of it being a constitutional monarchy, in a way, I believe. But obviously, that just gave them the opportunity to stage a coup. Yeah. And so that is what they used to overthrow her. Because she didn't have a great deal of experience with government, and so this very dangerous thing was embarked upon, and it just gave them the opportunity to overthrow the monarchy. Using again the Honolulu Rifles as their muscle, they took over the street. They formed what they called the Committee of Public Safety, which is never a good thing to form.
No. It implies that there's a need for such a thing, and yeah, that you can't take it for granted.
Exactly. And they take over control of the street, and they themselves form the Committee of Public Safety, which basically says, we're going to take over control of the running of the place. They then ask, as I was saying, shouting to the Americans, there's a United States ship in the harbor, and they say, please come and defend the streets. The American population could be in danger. And so the US Marines get sent in to secure the palace and all the major buildings and things like that. And that, from there, there's no going back. The monarchy is tried to be resuscitated a little by a royal guard guy by the name of Wilcox, who has already tried to stage a rebellion in 1888. He tries again shortly after the overthrow, as it's called. But unfortunately, it fails, and it implicates Liliuokalani, who has already had to abrogate power to the Committee of Safety. And they use that to try her, and they find her guilty of collusion, and she has to abdicate.
And that's the end of the Hawaiian monarchy.
That is the end. She spends the rest of her life trying to get people to help her restore it, because it's outright illegal what has happened.
Yeah.
But apparently the United States didn't care and were just rubbing their hands together and at the prospect of making it a territory. I mean, that's unfair. All right. I'm double checking myself, because at first the United States was a little cagey about actually just wading in there. But they do eventually, and they make it a territory and then a state, despite the pleas of poor Queen Liliuokalani and her, I think it's her niece, Kaialani. But sadly, nothing is done. Nothing can be done. Nobody is able to return Hawaii to the Hawaiian monarchy.
Oh, sad times. But thank you so much for coming on to share with us the story of the Hawaiian monarchy. We needed something like this from the Pacific, I feel. So this is Polynesian history, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I know we've butchered every name going, but it's because we've been determined to get the story out there.
Absolutely.
So please don't hate on us too much.
No.
Instead, and if anybody wants to sponsor us to go to Hawaii to learn how to pronounce names properly in situ, we will take that criticism on board. And troopers we are, we will go there.
We will go.
We will suffer a trip to Hawaii funded by someone else.
Yes, to make sure we do a series of videos from Waikiki Beach, from Waikiki, telling you about how to pronounce Hawaiian names.
Yes, I think it's full. Sounds like a foolproof plan. And obviously, whoever wants to fund that, just get in touch via Twitter.
Yes, absolutely. We will bite your hand off the committee.
completely just. Collaboration between History Land and History Hack.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
That's what will happen.
Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you very much for having me again, Alex.
And tell everyone where they can see your Historyland stuff.
On Twitter, it's at Land of History, and online, it's adventuresinhistoryland.com. Also on YouTube. But if you find one, you'll find the others. So be happy to see you if you stop by, especially with offer to go to Hawaii.
Join us on Monday when Nicholas Terry will be with us to talk all about 1941 and the Holocaust. This was a big year in terms of the evolution of the Final Solution. So don't miss it, because he's going to tell you what was going on and how we got to the horrific point where the Nazis tried to enact the Final Solution. Don't forget, you can become a patron of History Hack for as little as a dollar a month. Just go to www.historyhack.podbean.com. It will help us keep going in the aftermath of the coronavirus, and we would really appreciate it, as we would love to do so.